Hello, this is David Rovix with another episode of Discussions with David, a live stream broadcast I've been doing every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday during the pandemic, as long as I can't travel and play music for a living anymore. I'm also broadcasting on Mondays and Tuesdays. Mondays, I host Pandemic Open Mic Mondays, which anyone with a song, poem, or rant is encouraged to sign up for at davidrovix.com/POMM. Tuesdays, I host Fifth Estate Live, produced by Peter Werby. All of these live stream broadcasts start at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT every weekday, and you can find them both live and in archived form on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KABU Community Radio, and my own Facebook pages and channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. If you go to davidrovix.com or search on any podcasting platform for the podcast This Week with David Rovix, you can also find these programs in audio form soon after they're broadcast live. Another place you can find the broadcasts, along with lots of free content, as well as content reserved only for patrons, such as my 16-part audio memoir, is at patreon.com/davidrovix. That's also where you can support my various musical and non-musical efforts at Popular Education. Today, we return to New York City to talk to Dennis O'Neill, founding member of Liberation Road and Save Our Postal Service, among other groups. Dennis was my guest 2 weeks ago, and I wanted to get him back because there's too much more to talk about. When our discussion ended 2 weeks ago, there were plenty of things we hadn't gotten around to talking about yet, and now it's been 2 weeks since then, and even more stuff has happened since. Dennis, welcome back to my show.
I'm thrilled and I'm envious. You have such a nice, good sort of radio television voice. And I just want to assure the listening public here that I don't actually sound like this.
In reality,
what you're hearing is
much more resonance in the real Dennis's voice when you're in the room.
Right. What you're hearing is an artifact caused by the transmission of sound waves through air. I actually have a baritone, not unlike that of the late Paul Robeson. I can hear it very clearly when I speak, but I know it doesn't come across like that.
Of course, especially when you got good reverb, like in the bathroom or something. Like, you know. So, let's just kind of pick up where we left off. Although, you know, for anybody who wasn't watching the first one, they'll be fine. It's all stuff that everybody's hearing about and talking about and thinking about anyway. But the prospects, I mean, the way things have been going in the past couple of weeks, actually since we last talked, I don't even know how many right wingers have fired into crowds of protesters throughout this country and killed. There's been many people killed, many more permanently injured, many terrified, and there are right wingers going around with guns and using them. And occasionally they get arrested and caught. But, you know, a lot of people are wondering where this is going. And I'm also wondering, and this is a kind of a multi-part question, but I'm also wondering, is this something that you've had a lot of experience with in the past? Because, I mean, you've been around a while, and I don't know, I don't recall this being, police violence is one thing, but right-wingers firing into crowds of protesters on a regular basis, to me, is kind of, in this country, is kind of new, in my own lifetime anyway, unless I've just been in a hole somewhere not paying attention, but.
No, this is new, and one of the many frightening things that are happening under the sort of maybe the general sideboard of, is this fascism? And the closest equivalent you really have is in the civil rights movement. Where in the South, and especially in the Deep South, it was more or less open season on people who were organizing in the community, seen as being dangerous, and so on. And it was for a variety of reasons. There were not so many lynchings, large gatherings of people publicly hanging somebody and, you know, gloating and stuff. But there was still a fair amount of impunity for Klansmen, off-duty policemen, plain old pissed off white racists, to shoot somebody and get away with it. So that happened a bunch. Since then, I think that, and you would know this as well as I think that the closest equivalent that we have is some of the throwdowns between, you know, fascist skinheads and you know, people's skinheads, if you will, starting, I think, in the early 80s. And that various forms of armed combat between small groupings of sworn enemies. You know, the fash knew who we were, we knew who the fash were. Speaking broadly, the forces of sweetness and light. I was not, of course, part of this. But I was not, as many liberals were, disapproving of it. So you have the you have that stuff going on. This is very different, I think, because what's being targeted is you know, broad peaceful demonstrations, and you have the additional factor of the I forget what the hell it's called, but the current strategy du jour of some sections of the fascist right of trying to bring on a civil war and doing so by almost random killing that will be attributed to one side or the other. Doesn't matter. You know, I mean, they're shooting cops. If it makes other cops more likely to shoot demonstrators or black people or whatever, then that's fine. I mean, this is for a variety of reasons that everybody can figure out, not really a workable strategy, but it's causing a lot of fear, as you point out, and grief. So it's a thing.
Yeah. There was one, somebody I talked to, now, my mind is a bit of a sieve, but from one day to the next, I'm compartmentalizing, you know, okay, this is today, and this is what I'm doing, and then what I did yesterday, I don't even remember. But I was talking with somebody who was talking about how the fact that the police, that the military was not interested, it seemed, the leadership of the military and retired generals came out of the woodwork saying, we don't want military deployed to be shooting protesters and you know, doing the kind of stuff that Trump did in front of the White House. And do you think, like, I mean, there's so many different potential roads to fascism, but that may be one road that's less likely, like an actual martial law, but there's so many different ways to go there. I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting development. And, you know, these, if you are in the Pentagon, if you are on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, right, you have spent your entire career climbing and backstabbing and, you know, building up your base within the institution for a long time. And you've also been basking in public acclaim, most particularly since September 11th. So, and with the exception of the Air Force, which seems to be largely in the hands of Dominionist Christians, a scary bunch at the upper levels. And, you know, that is something, a continuing cause for concern.
What's a Dominionist Christian?
Those are the ones who think that basically God wants Christians to have dominion over the United States and the rest of the world as soon as possible, and nobody else has shit. And their definition of who is a Christian tends to be sort of narrow and unpleasant. So, you know, we're in Handmaid's Tale kind of territory. And there have been a bunch of interesting read don't read these before going to bed, studies of Dominionist ideology and of their infiltration into the military and particularly the Air Force. They, you know, and Colorado Springs, where the Air Force Academy is, and, you know, a lot of its high command or second level command, is also a stronghold of right-wing evangelical Christians, including many Dominionists. You know, I'm talking not just individuals, but your various churches, Bible thumpers, and so on. So, and those people think that persons such as ourselves, atheists, possibly of Jewish extraction in whole or part, should be dead. And, you know, that's a feature of this Dominionist ideology, and it's scary stuff.
And it's we got a step up from, oh, we're digressing already.
Yes, and I'm good at that.
Let's get back to fascism.
I never met a digression I couldn't take. back to, so I don't think that the danger particularly is from the high command, and I think they would be fairly iffy about a presidential order to declare martial law coming from Trump, you know, after he, not for Micah, loses the election catastrophically and then claims it was because of mail-in ballots sent in by undocumented immigrants or whatever he's going to claim.
It's a big threat.
Explain the catastrophic loss. I don't think he'll be able to mobilize them for that. But, you know, it leads into the bigger question of, I don't think that the Boogaloo Boys and the 3%ers and stuff like that actually represent the spearhead of a fascist movement. They're a threat. They're a piece of something that's going on. The problem that we have is that, this will seem like a digression, but isn't. Mm-hmm. If you're not, Hannah Arendt or some of the sort of right-wing, psychologically oriented Frankfurt School social democrats and stuff, you don't think that fascism is merely a product of certain personality types, but it's something that comes out of a set of economic and social relations.
Absolutely.
And generally, societies, see rise of fascist currents and movements and so on, and declines depending on what's going on among the populace, in the polity and in the economy. But generally speaking, and I mean, see, here, this is an actual digression, but we got to be careful when we talk about fascism and try to express a little bit what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
You know, I've been, as we've talked about, I go back quite a ways, and, you know, death to the fascist pig and other Panther slogans, of the time, there was, the left has declared fascism or thrown the term around repeatedly over the decades.
Yes.
And, you know, at times it's sunk to the level of being, meaning a really mean person.
I mean, now every time there's a Republican in power, the left, the elements of the left are screeching about fascism coming any moment. And right. Anytime there's a Democrat in power, the right are talking about how all their guns are going to get taken away and they're going to get sent to internment camps. I mean, so it seems to be a fairly widespread fear either way.
Yes, it is. And the thing, I think the thing to that I'd like to point to with this is, fascism doesn't mean, you know, fascist pigs are not exceptionally brutal ones or something like that. So generally, I'd say there's agreement among most people who think about this stuff on the left that fascism is an effort to build a movement which sets out to destroy bourgeois democracy and its norms, you know, the electoral stuff, the, you know, the public libraries. It aims to do it. And it aims to, and this is not as conscious a thing except by its financiers, it aims to get the big capitalists, the imperialists, call them what you will, out of a financial crisis or a political crisis in which they cannot realize the kind of profits that they're looking for. So that's, you know, and there are various ways that that's parsed. Now, this gets to the question of the military through the back door, right? If it is a movement to destroy bourgeois democracy, well, that is one answer to the question of, is Trump a fascist? Right? Because I would say no, hedged around with lots of caveats and stuff like that. But it cannot be denied that he is destroying many of the central institutions of a powerful monopoly capitalist ruled state. I mean, he's shredding everything. It's like he doesn't have a foreign policy so they can compete with other capital. It's like bang. And, you know, all the positions which have not been filled, all of that. All right. Well, that is certainly the erosion of the existing bourgeois democracy in the United States. And if the erosion continues or takes another leap in a different way, well, yes, you know, that lays the groundwork for what Trump vaguely conceives of, and Barr more, I think, in a more thought out way, toward an autocratic rule by one person. But if things don't go that way, you know, what does fill the vacuum?
Right.
Our hope is that it's a broad militant movement among the masses and different sectors, increasingly united, increasingly powerful, increasingly capable of articulating a program. Is it going to be a block of center and right Democrats and their capitalist backers and stuff? They've been pretty inept so far. So, and that's a situation where the military, I think, from the command level that you're talking about, would have a lot to say. I don't think that they would set up a junta, but I think they would be, you know, playing a more active role in discussions and, you know, determining where and when the National Guard is called up, not called up, et cetera.
And what about a Greensboro massacre scenario? What about the Greensboro massacre scenario? I mean, isn't that one step in that one potential way to, one of the aspects to engineering that kind of transition would be like, if with all the talk about defunding the police, if the police are suddenly out of the streets when there's a situation like that, and then the right wing can just kill, you know, just start massacring people.
I think that's likely to happen to some extent. And actually a much graver concern is, as the liberal approach, which is weeding the bad apples out of the barrel, or I guess sorting them out of the barrel. You don't weed out of a barrel, right?
We're both fairly urban, but I think you don't weed out, unless you're growing algae, maybe.
Right. We'll have to ask Dodie about this. She's
right.
The rural expert on this, but I don't think you weed bad apples out of a barrel. You pick them out so they don't spoil the others. That's the liberal approach, and defunding is our approach, right? There are going to be an awful lot of both bad apples and cops who have been made redundant, as the Brits say, laid off, lost their gigs because there ain't the money there. And so you have, you already have going on, and this was clearly at work in Minneapolis and some of the other rebellions early on. The police just withdrew.
Right.
You know, they did not have to abandon the Third Precinct Station House and have it burned down. They could have held it. They could have brought in reinforcements. They let that happen.
Yep.
Got their troops fired up and made the good guys supposedly look bad, but actually look kind of badder than they are in a different sense, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And did not cause the huge wave of public revulsion they were counting on. So, yeah.
But among some elements, a lot of revulsion and a lot of ammunition, ideological ammunition to be saying that Antifa is some kind of massive, well-organized network
that's one of the things I was, you know, I think we've got, because, you know, this was, these upsurges, or this upsurge in its various manifestations, I think we all realize, I mean, if you characterize it as anything, this is Black Lives Matter. It's not Antifa or Antifa or whatever however we're pronouncing it this month.
I don't know why there's such a discussion about how to pronounce Antifa. It's just short for anti-fascist. It comes from Germany. You know, how they put the emphasis on syllables in Germany, and then like it's such a bizarre
particular synapse snaps.
Yeah,
that's what I go when I'm saying it. But you know, I mean, there is no question that people who identify themselves as Antifa, even in the narrow sense, you know, as I am a person whose politics are defined around fighting fascists and preventing the growth of fascism, as well as people who are Antifa in the broader sense. And, you know, as soon as Trump started ranting about that, I put a thing on my Facebook page, said, hey, I'm Antifa. I've been Antifa since, you know, the 1960s. Come and get my ass, you sorry sack of shit. You know, and lots of people did and said things like that. But it was, I think what has happened in a lot of these things, especially in the larger cities, has been informed by people with Antifa or Antifa experience participating. They have dealt with the cops. They have dealt with right-wingers and fascists. They are not social pacifists. They do not have to have a big debate about, you know, is it wrong to chunk this bottle of ice water or whatever weapons we're supposed to be using? You know, or it's more like under what circumstances is it correct to do that? So I think that this moment has been informed by Antifa and built by it. And that's a good thing, but it's not really an Antifa moment. You know, the things that we're looking at, the fascists who are coming around, the Boogaloo Boys, the Three Percenters, I guess the Proud Boys are popping their little heads up again and stuff. They're not playing a major role, I don't think, in this. And so people dealing with them, you know, it's fine, but really, you know, the fascists we're dealing with in a lot of these demonstrations are the cops.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? I mean, that's the thing that anybody trying to understand U.S. society, I think, has to understand that the police have long been a sort of racist, neo-fascist organization. Where, I mean, like, I don't know if I mentioned this before to you, or if something I have mentioned on several occasions is that in Greece, you know, the how you vote is you vote according to your workplace rather than your residence. And so it's easy to tell according to your occupation how you vote. And the fascists are 50%. I mean, the police in Greece are 50% fascists.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, we're seeing this now. These are some of the smaller straws in the wind, you know. One, you know, the bad behavior of cops reenacting the killing of civilians caught on video, posted around.
After the killing of George Floyd, right? After the killing of George Floyd, there have been multiple occasions where police have been on video with their knees on black men's necks in multiple different states,
or
right?
Or each other's necks. Just ha, ha, ha. Isn't this a groove?
You know? Oh, really? They're just taking selfies with that? Oh, my God.
If you don't have a black person handy, because the ones on the police force have guns, and you might not want to have that little joke with them.
Right.
But you know, among your fellow racists and stuff, yeah, they've reenacted it and done it. And I think that's, you know, people are now blowing up the spot of a lot of cops on these email lists, Facebook groups, etc., who are posting this stuff themselves, talking about it, you know, using racial epithets. I want to kill, you know, boom. So it's out there much more. And that's in the 2 weeks since last we talked. So that's a scary thing, because I think more than the military, which tends to work under discipline, you know, even active duty cops, and especially the ex-cops who are going to be floating around, are, you know, possible forces for a fascist fighting force.
You think there's going to be a lot of ex-cops roaming around, though? Because, I mean, there's going to be lots of budget cuts, but whether police budgets are actually going to get cut. I mean, look, like what's just happened in New York City, right? They cut the police budget and then put all that money into the police and the schools budget. So they just moved it around.
Yeah, they are going to move reluctantly on it. But also, you know, don't forget, we are in, the early stages of a fairly serious depression. And while the debate now is, are the feds going to bail out, you know, what is the ratio of small businessmen to cruise ship lines and other corporate giants that a possible next stimulus bill will go to, right? Who's going broke is states and municipalities. You know, and they can close down a lot of stuff, but they can't necessarily close down the schools and the sanitation department and stuff. And there's a lot of popular support for, you know, do we really need this many cops around here? And do they all have to dress like RoboCops? And, you know, how much does it cost to run that stupid armored personnel carrier the government gave you around town to make sure that joggers have their masks on or whatever they're doing? You know, I mean, it's there are going to be cuts, and there are also going to be people fired, not because you have this huge wave of progress and reform, although there are reform-minded stuff, but also because police chiefs are not stupid. You know, they see that, you know, if their people show their ass or kill somebody or both, they're in trouble. So they got to take on the police unions or work around them or something and clear people out. So I think, yes, there are going to be not, you know, hundreds of thousands of cops who have lost their jobs wandering around this country, but there are going to be thousands.
And that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people used to playing with guns. So.
Yeah. So we are talking with Dennis O'Neill on Discussions with David, which you can hear live at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT, Wednesday through Friday every week, along with other broadcasts I host at the same time on Mondays and Tuesdays. All of these broadcasts go out live on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KBU Community Radio, and elsewhere, and they're all archived on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovix, on Patreon at patreon.com/davidrovix, and in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform. So on Fifth Avenue, it now says Black Lives Matter in big yellow letters. The New York City is completely transformed now, where they've got public art.
It's I don't know. You know, this whole shift is kind of a remarkable thing to me.
Yeah.
Not that this is painted on Fifth Avenue and so on, but that there is no huge upsurge of outrage among average New Yorkers, including lots of middle-class white people who can still afford to be in the city, haven't been driven out yet or not. They're kind of, well, yeah, that's right. Black lives do matter. And also, fuck Trump. And it's right in front of his tower. So that's, you know, that shift to me is one of the most heartening things. And it suggests ways that we of the left can look at the task of building both the absolutely necessary, in my opinion, broad anti-Trump front necessary to, you know, just obliterate him, blow him to smithereens in the election, but also to do so with a force that's capable of affecting the politics to come afterwards. Because some of the pieces for fascism, just to even to leave the rest of it out, but some of the conditions for fascism that we have been talking about will not vanish with Trump at all. And, you know, there's a danger that somebody actually somewhat smarter might come in and try to assume the Trump role. So, and you can't have a fight against fascism without the left, without the working class. Left liberals, centrist liberals don't understand it. They don't know what they're facing, and they haven't for quite a while. Mm-hmm. You know, they're still acting as if this is some bizarre aberration rather than not an inevitable, but a very definitely possible outcome of the way this system is run and who it's run by. So, you know, yes, you got a Trump, and they can't, they don't, you know, do you think Joe Biden knows anything about fascism?
No. One of the kind of hopeful things that's been happening recently that seems to be on the uptake is people talking, a lot of different organizations, leaders of organizations and people talking about how if Black Lives Matter, then, you know, the if-then statement, if Black Lives Matter, then what about housing as a human right? What about universal right. health care? What about all these things that disproportionately impact poor people and people of color, and Black people in particular? What if you any impressions about where that might be going? It seems very positive. In Marketplace, morning report on Marketplace this morning, I heard the host and his guest agreeing that the U.S. economy is rigged.
I think that's absolutely true. And that's, you know, this is something that comes directly up in my own work, as I think I talked about last time. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to keep the U.S. Postal Service funded from, you know, dramatic loss of income during the Rona, but also in the face of passionate hostility from Trump, who is worried about the vote by mail. And from various disaster capitalists who would just love to piece it out, take it apart, you know, grab the pieces that will pay and throw the rest away. And one of the things that we bring up and that resonates with people, besides, you know, that folks in rural areas rely on the post office and veterans, and, you know, we send, I forget what it is, something like 2 billion prescriptions go through the mail every year to people, right? The Postal Service is and has been for many decades a bulwark of the stable Black working class. We have about 500,000 workers in the post office now. Over, I think it's like 104,000 of them are African American. And, you know, generations of people have passed the test, got a job in the post office, maybe taken some shit from racist supervisors and stuff, but they also had unions they could turn to protect them, and they went to the EEO, whatever it was. And in the meantime, they had the job. They got paid the same as everybody else. Women got paid the same as the men. Everybody got paid, and they got paid enough and had benefits decent enough that you could get a house or rent a decent apartment. You could raise a family. You could send your damn kids to college. And so, you know, in terms of Black Lives Matter, we better hang on to the damn Postal Service, because if they shred that, all that is gone. You know what I mean? The civil service test to get in, and the egalitarian hiring. You know,
one of the last good union jobs. I mean, it used to, Flint, Michigan was, I think in the 60s, Flint, Michigan was actually had overall the highest living standard in the country, right? Because when you, or how, you know, if measured by what do they call average wage or median wage or whatever it is. But basically, yeah, because a good union job's at General Motors.
Right. GM, you know, who I used to work for, not in Flint, but in Detroit back years ago in the 60s.
When did you work? When were you in Detroit? I don't know about that part.
Well, I had briefly attended the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and sort of under parental pressure, so I wouldn't get drafted. So I went there. I hated it. It was like high school, only worse. And I was not very good at high school either. So I wound up spending a lot of time in Detroit and got a job at the Eldon Avenue gear and axle plant, part of the Lynch Road Assembly Complex, Chrysler Corporation. And that was quite a learning experience for me. I had worked in factory jobs when I was in high school, or a factory job, but it was a little tiny plant. We made office furniture, correspondence files for the FBI, among other clients. And we used to send nasty notes to J. Edgar Hoover, me and my partner who worked at the same plant. And oddly enough, they never came for us, which means, I suppose, that the agents who were in charge of unpacking and setting these things up really thought we had a point. So, but, you know, as far as I know, there's nothing in my files about it or anything. So anyway, there I was in Detroit. And yeah, that was a good buck. That was not me getting a factory job to be a organizer of the proletariat. That stage of my political understanding came later. I wanted to be like Stackily, as a folk singer, you'll appreciate this, right? You know, Stackily was a bad man. Everybody knows, spent him $100 on just one suit of clothes. Well, you know, I transposed it from whatever, $1935 to $1970 or $68, whatever it was. But I did. I worked in that factory and I made a good buck, and I bought myself a nice suit of clothes. It was a suit, but it also had a pair of slacks that went with the jacket, but didn't match. It was very nice.
Were you there in 67, or that was a little before? You were too young.
I was there. I moved to Michigan after the riot, the 67 riot. But because I had a friend. I lived in, when I moved from Ann Arbor into Detroit, I lived in an apartment on Claremont and Woodrow Wilson, which was about three blocks from the Blind Pig where the riot started. So I was, you know, one of the very few melanin deficiency syndrome sufferers within a several mile radius, probably. It was not a lot of white folks around back then, but
how neighborhoods change.
It was just a fluke. You know, I was, I knew this guy from some summer program in New York that I had gone to, and he said, well, you know, my mom's got room, come stay with us. So I did.
Great.
And I worked in the plant, and made the buck. But my mother persuaded me to leave because the draft board was now breathing down my neck since I was no longer registered at the University of Michigan. So I came back east and tried college for one more year and then said, fuck it, the draft can have me. I'm just not doing this. So,
and then they didn't want you because they were afraid you might organize inside the military? At that point, they started getting afraid of that.
More of a, that by the time they got around to calling me up, and I was giving talks and handing out anti-war papers and stuff at my draft physical. They, you know, in earlier years, that probably would have earned me, you know, getting drafted and sent to a, one of those radar things, a dew line station up in Alaska for 2 years, you know, right? And seeing two other human beings the whole time and freezing to death. Yeah. But by this point, they had so much trouble in the military, you know, just rebellions and protests and everything that they took a look at my form that I had filled out when I went there, and they said, well, I see that you have bad eyesight and cancer and irregular menstrual periods and homosexuality. And I had just checked yes to everything. She said, well, okay, I don't think we're going to take you. So that was that.
So Dennis, what's the situation now with the post office? You were talking about there's been COVID outbreaks and the managers are not telling the workers.
In some instances, yes, there's a great deal of unevenness. It's not a well-managed situation, the post office institution in general. And the entire Postal Board of Governors and the brand newly inaugurated Postmaster General, a guy named Louis DeJoy, all of them are Trump appointees, and none of them have any experience with the post office. So people were trying to make it work with spit and baling wire before. So, yeah, I mean, the unevenness is massive. There are states where everybody wears a mask at work, and it's enforced by management and backed by the union, or enforced by the union and backed by management. And there's a lot of grousing, some of it from, you know, Trumpies who, yeah, I mean, I see a lot of emails and stuff about this, you know, people who think that they're going to die of carbon dioxide poisoning because they have this piece of cloth on their face. And, you know, we gently point out that, no, what you're worried about is carbon monoxide poisoning. That comes from the combustion of fossil fuels. And carbon dioxide will not poison you anywhere near as quickly. But if you'd like to try a little experiment, we say, put a mask on for 2 minutes, breathe in and out, you know, see how it feels. Take it off, put a plastic bag on your head and tighten it around your neck. Then, you know, you'll see what it's like to re-inhale your carbon dioxide and not be able to inhale any oxygen. It feels different, doesn't it? And so, yeah, but it's a constant struggle that's going on. And to get back to your question, somebody I saw on a list posted a picture of a car in a parking lot. And there was one car in the parking lot. the one that the picture was taken over the hood of, it was empty. And the person wrote, last night, somebody came in and told us that a person in the facility had been found to have, to be COVID-19 positive. And this may be one of the places we've been encouraging people to organize themselves, not to walk away entirely, but to say, we're leaving until this place is cleaned out and we're doing it together so that you can't pick us off.
And that happened.
There's a rigmarole of forms to fill out and so on that you say, I believe my life is in danger if I'm working under unsafe conditions and I'm applying for leave for that reason. You submit those on your way to the door, or you say, you call in and say, I'm not coming in, and I'll submit the forms when I come in. And generally, this happens not all the time, but it happens more than once in a while. And what happens is, generally, they get somebody in there to clean the facilities and clean them well. And also, that was a place where it came as a sudden shock. Where we can, we organize people in, you know, the facilities, from the huge sorting plants to little, you know, one postmaster and three carrier stations. Think Cornwall Bridge, right? We tell people, make sure you all have each other's contact information. If you get sick, call your coworkers, because you cannot rely upon management to do this. Also, if you get sick and, you know, you have little red spots all over your body that itch a lot, call your coworkers and say, I don't have COVID. I was in a patch of poison ivy, you know, so that people don't worry unnecessarily. And the reason they can't name the people who do it, because of there's a law, HIPAA, which says that you can't publicly discuss people's medical condition. Doctors can't, et cetera, unless you give them permission. So what a lot of postal management has done is just silence. Don't tell people, don't let people know. So we're sort of counter-organizing against that.
Then this, I know this is a terrible digression here, no question about it. But when I first stayed in your apartment in New York City in the early 1990s, along with a wall covered with a incredible vinyl record collection, you know where this is going, right? You also had a bunch of newspaper clippings up, which were sort of various examples of the term that had then become popular, which I think most people have never heard of. If they're young people, they've never heard the term now, but it's a term that used to be well known, called going postal. And you had a very interesting theory about why these things happen in some post offices and not others. And now the whole theory might be irrelevant because there's been so many more massacres since then and so many other workplaces.
I had a riff about it, and I'll run just a part of it. But it was, you know, postal workers generally don't get a whole ton of respect. You know, word association tests, bread, butter, you know, mattress, fitted sheet, postal worker, fat, lazy, overpaid. There was this brief moment when, you know, around the country, a bunch of my coworkers were slipping his or her mooring. Well, actually his moorings, let's be frank, and shooting coworkers and supervisors and stuff. So which is where the term going postal came from. And for that 3 or 4 year span, you had respect. You know, people would say, and what do you do? You know, and I'd say, I'm a postal worker. You got some kind of problem with that? Well, no, sir. It was a result of a lot of factors, speed up, heavy pressure from management, the fact that the Postal Service. You know, there are things about the hiring procedure that didn't weed out people who would not have made it through in private industry and so on. And also, you know, it's just these things go in cycles, you know. It happened, and then all of a sudden, you know, there were a couple of poorly socialized teenagers in black trench coats out in Colorado someplace.
They got all the attention after that.
And you know, we were out of the highlights, and you know, high school and junior high school kids were shooting up their classes for a period. So there's a copycat, or, you know, kind of, you know, I've been treated badly here and I'm drunk. I'll show these motherfuckers just like they did in whatever. And the other part of the theory was you didn't have these things for the most part in large city post offices. And the reason for that is our supervisors, our immediate floor supervisors, were so busy trying to stab each other in the back and climb the ladder, and our unions were generally stronger and could protect people from harassment and so on. So it didn't happen. It was like Royal Oak, Michigan, there was one. There were, you know, a number of them around the country. And people knew I was interested in it. So when it happened, friends from wherever it was would send me the local newspaper with the front page headline, so I didn't have to rely on you know, the Daily News or the New York Times. I could
much better that way when it's more
variety. I could follow it more closely, yes, the mm-hmm. details, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they were always described as quiet loners, so I think that's why management was never afraid of me. I wasn't all that sociable, but I was never quiet. So,
and so, it just in the past few days, to change the subject again, there's been a lot of mainstream news coverage about how totally fucked the situation is in the United States, basically with the virus, and how we're looking at 100,000 new cases a day. And I mean, any thoughts on? Where this is going? I mean, the police have just raided the CHOP in Seattle and taken back their police station, and I believe there's been similar attempts, or I don't know what the latest is on City Hall in New York City, but there's a similar stuff happening there.
Yeah, I didn't hear that about the Seattle occupation
two nights ago at 5 in the morning.
What?
Yeah, two nights ago at 5 in the morning.
That's what we did. That's what they did to us at Occupy Wall Street.
You know? Always 5 in the morning. It's their favorite time. Yeah.
They'll roll up when it's hard to assemble reinforcements. And actually, once at Occupy, we got a little bit of a tip off and all the unions were called. And, you know, a couple thousand union members showed up.
Yeah, when they announce it in advance, it's great, right? Here in Portland, the mayor said, we're going to raid Occupy at midnight, and 5,000 people were there. Right. So they waited till 5 in the morning.
Right. So this is, you know, I mean, they're going to clear it out. I mean, it's a good tactic. It was a good tactic in Occupy. It's a good tactic in the current struggle. But you need a strategy. If all you have is tactics, your tactics become your strategy. And there is no tactic that can't be solved by the enemy. You know, I mean, they have people who are paid big bucks to think about this stuff all the time and figure it out. And so whether it's an occupation, whether it's a hunger strike, whatever tactic you adopt, it may have a huge effect for a while. And then they will figure out how to put the quietus on it. So, in a sense, I think Seattle and even to a certain extent City Hall, although it's more a building than a broader kind of liberated zone thing, does recapitulate the message of Occupy, which is that we, the 99%, or however you want to parse it, the 98%, how inclusive you are capable of creating new forms of society, new ways of being in the world, new ways of interacting. And, you know, that's why you had strong suspicions in Seattle of provocation in the case of that one shooting there, you know, because then the message is, see, you need the cops, you can't do that, you know. And, you know, that's one way for them of answering the tactic. It wasn't that effective because that was, what, a week and a half ago, and they're only closing it down now. So we just have to see how these things are going to roll. But we also have to keep our eyes on the larger picture.
So. Do you have any particular strategic ideas that you're thinking of when you talk about this, that as a tactic as opposed to a strategy?
Well, I mean, I think, no, I don't have particularly good ideas. I have some inclinations. Mm. I'll give you my inclinations. I think that the trade union movement, which was considerably weakened, has been to some extent more weakened by COVID-19 because their usual way of working in Washington at the national headquarters and stuff has all been disrupted. They're all sitting around home in their footsie pajamas just like us and trying to, you know, get people to do stuff on the phone, and it doesn't work as well. But the trade union movement is probably the largest single organized force, if it can be brought to bear, to deal with the immediate situation, which is smashing Trump and as much of the structure that he's built, the Republican Party and all that. And we have to do it based on building, you know, strong areas, central labor council, states where the unions have been particularly strong or particularly effective, and build it up and out from there, even strong locals. So that's a piece of it. Another piece of it is starting to figure out how we keep the momentum going on the Black Lives Matter thing. Because an important part of the momentum came from militant struggle in the streets. But you can't keep doing that and keep doing that and keep doing that. And the more that things become peaceful marches with permits and vigils with candles and stuff, some of the energy falls out and some of chunks of the riled up youth and urban poor and stuff who have made the thing happen start to fade away. So I think we have to work on a lot of fronts. I think, you know, the stuff we talked briefly about last time, what the hell do they call it? Mutual aid and other forms of social. Anarchist concept, but it's been taken up by lots of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do we do that? How do those forms that we've built interact with each other,
yeah,
with rent strikes and those sorts of things, and with public services in the municipalities or wherever that you're doing the work? How do you create a composite whole that's part of a united front that puts forward demands and that positions us to, as I say, you know, with luck, assuming things go well, a decisive smashing of Trump and hopefully the Senate Republicans in the election, you know, then our work is not done. We do not go, woo-hoo, you know, back to waiting around for a vaccine and not doing anything. You know, we got to keep the heat on and use the momentum that was built. This is a very peculiar upsurge that we're in now, because in a lot of ways, it started electorally, which almost never happens. Usually you have an upsurge and then politicians trail after. And then when the you hit the peak of the upsurge, you do a little more electoral work to try to consolidate the gains. In significant degree, a big part of what we're doing now came out of the Bernie Sanders stuff in 2016. Mm. And that's, I don't know about unprecedented. I have to rebrief myself on the history of the early Debs campaigns, but
right.
You know, hasn't happened in over 100 years that provided the motor, you know. And yes, it was fed by the Black Lives Matter movement and people participating across that. And it was definitely fed by Occupy. A lot of people would cut their teeth on Occupy went in. Mm-hmm. But that was what got us, you know, sort of to the current point. And so we have to think now about what we're going to do about elections, because it ain't the same as it was. It's things look different. And do we go for a new party, and how quick, and, you know, how soon do we raise the slogan, you know, wire Chuck Schumer to the engine block of a 1947 DeSoto and drop him in the East River, you know. And it's probably not quite that soon, actually.
We're not quite there yet, I guess, huh? But it's a good one.
In a lot of kind of united fronts that are going to be awkward, but we have done well enough, and we have this the wind of the post George Floyd upsurge in our sails. And the dramatic transformation in mass understanding in this country of the slogan Black Lives Matter, not that we've won, oh good, our work is done, but we have the ability to bring considerable force to bear on whatever the situation is post-election. So.
Mm-hmm. We'll stop there, I suppose, on that note. Dennis O'Neill, thank you so much for joining me again. And definitely other people have been enjoying this conversation. And somebody in Norway says, holy wow, my two favorite Americans at once. So I believe he's a Maori.
I will say this. Well, many Norwegians are very cosmopolitan and do a lot of world traveling and stuff. It is quite possible that we are also the only two Americans that this party knows. So it's, I wouldn't take it as a giant compliment. You get to see stuff. I don't.
Yeah, I get to see the comments. There's just a few.
I don't see any comments or little hearts going up or throwing up emojis or any of the feedback stuff. But
people rarely ask questions. If people asked questions, I'd relay them to you. But when it's just like, great show, thanks, you know, I tend to just not mention it.
That's good. Yeah. All right. Well, you know, I think people have had a substantial dose of me. maybe when we hit the fall, something interesting will be going on, and I'll come back, because this is fun.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Let's do it again. Yeah, you know, there's always lots of stuff happening within the space of a few months to have another few weeks to have another conversation.
And there's days. And we haven't gotten to the economy yet, which is a big one. And,
oh, there we go.
You know, that's
let's talk about the economy next time.
Or we could just talk about music and culture in the Rona era.
See, we got two more shows lined up right there.
Okay. Whatever.
Yeah. Thanks.
Later, Dennis.
Yeah. Take care.
Good.
And thanks, everyone, for tuning into this conversation with Dennis O'Neill. You can find this and other discussions with David in archived form in various locations, such as the Discussions with David playlist on youtube.com/drovix, at patreon.com/davidrovix, at soundcloud.com/davidrovix, and on any podcasting platform if you search for the podcast This Week with David Rovix. My latest album, Notes from a Failed State, is now up on Spotify and all the other usual music streaming platforms. To celebrate, I'll be having a little one-man album release party this Saturday, July 4th, broadcast on whatever platform you're watching on, from here in my living room at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. GMT. The music, the live stream broadcasts, and the podcasts are all free, but if you want to support my journalistic and musical efforts, plus have access to some exclusive offerings just for patrons, please join my community-supported art program or CSA at davidrovics.com/subscribe or patreon.com/davidrovics. Artists for Rent Control is now set up to start organizing an emergency eviction response team. Please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up. Tomorrow, I'll be spending the hour with singer-songwriter, author of songs like Cows with Guns, Turn of the Wrench, and loads of other great songs, Dana Lyons from Bellingham, Washington. Hope to see you again soon here in the Matrix and out on the streets. Don't pay the rent, and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.